quantities of fishing gear in places in Alaska are just staggering.
A new study evaluates the ocean trash problem. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 22nd of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, reviving a decades-old idea for connecting Western Alaska to the road system.
And the idea for a road to Nome has existed since before statehood, and we need to move forward.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Lack of maintenance is the primary reason heating oil tanks contaminate drinking water, sewers, and stormwater drains. Homeowners are liable under state law for the cleanup of spills from home heating oil tanks on their property. So prevent spills by arranging an inspection of tanks and heating equipment before and during the heating season. Information online at dec.state.ak.us. Click on the Spill Prevention and Response link. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation.
Powerful lawmakers and prominent Alaskans are on the list of more than 200 potential witnesses in the federal trial of Senator Ted Stevens. Alaska's senior senator faces 7 felony counts of lying on his financial disclosure forms. APRN's Libby Casey reports from Washington.
Former Secretary of State Colin Powell is on the potential witness list, along with Senators Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts, Daniel Inouye of Hawaii, Orrin Hatch of Utah, and Vermont's Patrick Leahy. Former Alaska Governor Bill Sheffield may be called on to testify. So might a number of Native leaders, including Alaska Federation of Natives President Julie Kitka, Carl Mars, the former president of Cook Inlet Regional Native Corporation, and Gloria O'Neill, Cook Inlet Tribal Council President. Barrow Whaling Captain and Chairman of the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, Oliver Levitt, is also on the list. So are dog mushers, past Iditarod winner Dean Osmar, and David Monson, the husband of late Iditarod champion Susan Butcher. Mixed in among the who's who of Alaska are Stevens' neighbors and former staff members and employees of oil field services company Vico. Stevens is accused of taking gifts from Vico worth more than $250,000. Some of the people listed may be character witnesses for Stevens, while others, like Vico employees, are expected to testify about the gifts. There are indications that Stevens' lawyers may question the credibility of the government's star witness, Vico CEO Bill Allen. One of the potential witnesses is Bambi Tyree. She's been tied to Allen and in 2005 pleaded guilty in an Anchorage sex and drug ring involving teenage girls. The judge read the list of possible witnesses Monday morning to more than 150 potential jurors who had to make note if they knew anyone on the list. The jurors filled out a 21-page questionnaire about their background, education, experience with the legal system, and ability to serve. They were asked what comes to mind when they think of Alaska and for their overall opinion of the ethics and honesty of members of Congress. The 66 questions included a section asking jurors if they've ever renovated their home and if it was a positive or negative experience. One of the gifts Stevens is alleged to have concealed is the renovation of his Girdwood house. A batch of possible jurors will return to the federal courthouse Tuesday morning after lawyers from both sides have reviewed the questionnaires. Then the process of selecting the final jury will begin. Senator Stevens appeared in court as the proceedings began Monday. He, his wife, and son Walter may testify in the coming weeks. Stevens' lawyers have filed paperwork waiving his right to appear at trial from time to time when he needs to fulfill Senate duties. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
The National Research Council says 20 years of regulations and international treaties have failed to tackle the problem of garbage in the ocean. The congressionally chartered study concludes the problem of marine debris is likely to get worse without substantial effort at the national and international levels. It calls for the United States and the international maritime community to adopt a goal of zero discharge at sea. Lead author Keith Criddle is a Juneau-based professor of marine policy at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He says nets, traps, and other derelict fishing gear can remain in the water for many years.
It may sink for a period of time. As it becomes fouled, it may float back up again. And so gear that washes ashore could be a legacy of fishing that took place many years in the past. the quantities of fishing gear in places in Alaska are just staggering.
The report recommends that local ports make it easier and cheaper for boats to dispose of their old fishing gear and other waste on shore. Criddle says the problem is poorly documented beyond what some local coastal cleanups are able to collect.
We don't know much about what's ashore in more remote areas, let alone the amount of material that's floating in the open ocean or beneath the surface.
Marcus Erickson knows more about remote ocean garbage than most people. The head of the Algalita Marine Research Foundation sailed from California to Hawaii this summer on a raft made of 15,000 plastic bottles. Erickson says plastic garbage was everywhere in the middle of the Pacific, with fragments of plastic bags and water bottles the most common plastics at sea. He says two-thirds of the world is ocean, and now it's a plastic soup. He's speaking about his 87-day voyage across the North Pacific tonight at 7 at the University of Alaska Southeast in Juneau. Western Alaska Access was a central topic at a think tank-sponsored conference in Talkeetna over the weekend. The Institute of the North event considered energy, transportation, and resource development in looking at a controversial high-dollar road or railroad project. Nils Andreasen with the Institute says opening up a Fairbanks to Nome corridor is aimed at addressing economic woes in rural Alaska.
The general idea is not to do transportation by itself. We're looking at telecommunications, energy transmission, natural gas for a line along that route. The more pieces you include in an infrastructure corridor, helping drive down the cost of the project itself and open up more potential than existed before.
Andreasen says the daunting cost of building a road or laying train track across hundreds of miles of rugged terrain and questions about environmental, social, and cultural impacts have not deterred an Institute of the North study group.
People who participated in the study group, at least, believe there's an inherent value to connecting communities. As far as economics go, the general perception is that if there were large resource development projects along the route, they would help drive the economics.
Consideration of the project comes as the state conducts a Western Alaska road access study. Andreasen says a public-private partnership between government and industry would be essential to move such a massive project ahead.
We want to move things toward action. We've been talking for a long time in the state about doing some of these projects. And the idea for a road to Nome has existed since before statehood. I've got a pile of 33 studies that have been conducted since 1972, I think. And we need to move forward if we're really going to grow the state and support our communities.
The Institute of the North used the weekend conference to develop alternative visions for moving ahead on the transportation, energy, and resource fronts over the next 50 years. The Institute of the North was founded by former Governor Wally Hickel. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, we continue our trip down the Alsek River.
At one point, we were going 14 miles an hour on a raft. That's like, that's fast. That's ripping.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
9 out of 10 of Alaska's boating fatalities are adult males. Most drowned following an unexpected fall or capsize into cold water. Cold water can kill the unprepared, regardless of swimming ability. Wearing a life jacket can make the difference between life and death. Make your family's boating memories good ones. Always wear a life jacket when boating Alaska's cold water. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Southeast Alaska saying fishermen had a far below average pink salmon total this year. While dockside prices were up substantially, effort was down, and there was a lot less time and area to fish because of the poor pink returns. Those low numbers are troubling to fishery managers who say many northern southeast streams did not meet escapement goals. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
Saners landed a total of 13.8 million pink salmon this year. That's less than a third of the 10-year average. Bill Davidson is the Department of Fish and Game's Regional Management Coordinator in Southeast Alaska.
You know, the 10-year average harvest for pink salmon is around 41.6 million pinks, and the long-term average is around 25.7 million pinks. So we're well below both of those two averages that we use as a benchmark to kind of compare years. We're a little bit better than we were in 2006, where the harvest was 10.1 million, but it was a weak year.
In fact, catches for all species in the seine fishery were on the low side. Davidson says the 74,000 fish sockeye catch was the second lowest since 1975. The fleet landed 15,000 chinook and 200,000 coho, also well below average. Davidson says the 3.1 million chum catch was below the recent 10-year average, but above the longer-term average since statehood. While catches were down, higher prices bolstered the overall value of the commercial harvest. Davidson says prices for pinks averaged 27 cents a pound and chum were averaging 61 cents a pound.
In 2007, the prices were 15 cents for pinks and 31 cents for chum. So we were double that. And going back a further year, it was 12 cents for pinks and 30 cents for chum. So the prices did help to make up for low totals.
The total dockside value of the seine fishery was about $32 million this year, including both hatchery and wild stock salmon. That compares with about $38 million last year. So the overall value was not nearly as depressed as the catch from the year before. Catches were decent mainly in southern southeast and some areas on the outside northern coast, but managers were concerned about returns on the northern inside waters.
We had major portions of the region where we had negligible harvests, almost from Frederick Sound north on the inside. Escapements were poor, harvests were poor. So there's something going on affecting survivals.
Davidson says there are many variables that can affect the survival of salmon, but he thinks colder water temperatures played a role not only in the ocean, but also in the streams in which these returns were spawned in 2006.
So kind of heavy precipitation, snowpack, causing cold temperatures and near shore, causing, you know, the fish to grow slowly, their food supply to not be as abundant is part of the problem. And then some freshwater environment problems might be occurring on top of that.
Along with the lower catch, participation was also down this year. Just 212 seiners made landings. That's only a little over half the number of permits in Southeast. And Bill Davidson says it's the second lowest amount of effort on record. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
While low fish returns are tough on fishermen, they're also tough on hatcheries, which generate a significant portion of their revenues from cost recovery or harvesting and selling some of their adult fish returns. KCAW's Bonnie Sue Hitchcock reports.
Salmon landed in Southeast Alaska are subject to a 3% salmon enhancement tax, which goes to regional nonprofits like the Northern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association, or NSARA, in Sitka, and the Southern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association, or SARA, in Ketchikan. But non-regional hatcheries don't receive any of the salmon enhancement tax. That includes Armstrong Keita's Port Armstrong Hatchery at the southern end of Baranoff Island. Steve Reifenstuhl, operations manager for NSARA, says the salmon enhancement tax, which his organization gets, is administered by the legislature. Last year, the set tax paid to NSARA was $1.3 million.
Fish and Game set up the hatchery program starting in about 1970. And the program built from there, and then the legislature wanted to expand that in the Hammond administration, and so they created the private nonprofit hatchery program. And then within that There was a regional associations and what's called non-regional associations.
Reifenstuhl says the regional and non-regional hatchery programs are set up differently. Regionals serve a much larger population and can have as many as 25 to 40 members on their elected boards, whereas the non-regionals have smaller boards and serve a smaller area. But he says in the 1970s, there was a big interest in starting up non-regional hatcheries around the state.
Well, the incentive is people that wanted to be involved in enhancement could start programs and generate fish for the common property, for the common good, and make enough money in cost recovery to pay for the operational costs. That was the theory. It's been much more difficult than that.
Both regional and non-regional hatcheries rely on grants and loans for funding, but non-regional hatcheries rely mainly on the cost recovery harvest every year for the bulk of their funding.
Fish that come back from our production to our facilities that are surplus to our egg needs that we can harvest and sell to the processors, and we're paid for those, and that's what funds our operation.
Sam Raybung is the operations manager of Armstrong Keita Incorporated. He says the Port Armstrong hatchery has been around for over 25 years and is a huge contribution to the troll fleet, especially out of Port Alexander. But he says when they have low returns, like with this year's pinks, it makes the upcoming year look pretty skinny.
The pink return was a real disappointment in our area. It looks like we'll have just brood stock. We won't have enough for a cost recovery. They're generally at least a half of our revenue projection every year. So we're looking at only having enough funding, depending on the coho return. But it looks like we'll only have half the revenue that we need to operate for a year for 2009.
While low returns were projected this year, it came as somewhat of a surprise at Port Armstrong, because Raybung says the high mortality rate is usually in the freshwater phase of the salmon's life cycle, and that phase is bypassed when fish are released from the hatchery.
So we thought that our fish would do quite well, seeing as there were so few naturally spawned fish out there, that ours would have plenty of food. And also coming back when there's a low projection, management tends to be very conservative so as not to over-harvest the returning fish.
Raybung says it comes with the territory that there will always be years where the returns are going to be lower than others. He says the bigger question is how to keep afloat during the lean years. He says many people might not even be aware of the contribution Port Armstrong makes to the industry.
And I think that people have become accustomed to, you know, our contribution without maybe even realizing it. And if it just stopped suddenly overnight, it may be missed. For example, last year we contributed 80,000 coho to the fleet, roughly $1 million to the troll fleet. You know, that might be missed.
But Raybung still says the 16 people who live and work at Port Armstrong do it because they believe in the mission and the lifestyle. Steve Reifenstuhl says in other places, there's more support for these kinds of programs.
In any other state in the United States, in any province in Canada, the federal government or the state government pays for these programs. That's the big difference.
Raybung says they'll pursue all their options to make up the deficit of the dismal pink return. He says the community that works in Port Armstrong isn't going to give up just because of one poor pink season. And he says they should see a real strong coho return in the coming year. In Sitka, I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, proud to support public broadcasting in Alaska, and by the Alaska Community Foundation, encouraging listeners to tune into AK every weekend. Your local public radio station has airtimes. APRN would like to thank Northern Air Cargo for sponsoring Alaska Morning News and Alaska News Nightly. To learn more about this sponsorship, call 907-550-8400.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
Southeast Alaska's Organization of Business and Government Leaders says new Census Bureau methods could harm the region. The Southeast Conference is asking federal officials to make sure rural residents are fully counted. The census issue is one of several addressed by conference delegates during their annual meeting. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Census Bureau has changed the way it updates its population information, and state officials say the change could reduce the count of rural, minority, and low-income Alaskans. Nicole Gruey of the State Department of Community and Regional Affairs was one of the speakers at this year's Southeast Conference annual meeting in Prince Rupert, British Columbia. She told members that funding cuts have pushed the Census Bureau to make changes that could provide inaccurate counts. They include less data collection in small communities and too much dependence on street addresses and telephone landlines. She says a quarter to a half of some communities' residents could be missed.
Essentially, for rural Alaska, since they're generally proposing a lower sample size, it will increase your sampling error. The lower the sample size, the higher your sampling error, the higher your margin of error.
Conference delegates approved a resolution asking the Bureau to ensure rural counts are accurate and complete. Census data is used to determine the size of grant funding as well as the makeup of voting districts. Southeast Conference delegates also voted to support development of the Oceans Alaska Marine Science Center in Ketchikan, and it backed an effort to help Southeast businesses make use of Prince Rupert's new container port. New Conference Board President Mike Korsmo says the port has potential for Southeast.
I know that from my perspective, from up Skagway, we see some definite opportunities with what's going on in Prince Rupert, and then the connection up through the Inside Passage, then up into the Yukon territories, because there's a lot of potential for transshipment of goods. And I think these guys are starting there. They're ahead of the game right now, and we're going to try to follow suit.
Conference delegates also approved a bylaws change that opens the door for more formal tribal involvement. Korsmo says tribes could already be members of the organization. Now their representatives can run for board seats.
We actually added federally recognized tribes within the bylaws, and then we came up with a mechanism for votes. And then we also recognized the federally recognized tribes as a public entity. So it really what it does is opens up... Really, if you're a federally recognized tribe, you're open for a public seat. If you're a corporation, you're open for the private seat.
The tribal vote is one example of a cooperative tone some say has been developing in the conference. Speakers made fewer attacks on environmental and other groups they've opposed in some past meetings. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Prince Rupert.
Disaster struck two raft trips on the Alsek River this summer, leaving a father and son dead on one trip. Another trip was nearly ruined when a calving glacier flooded the boaters' campsite. KTOO's John Ryan reported Friday on the preparations one group took to avoid a similar fate in the remote wilderness north of Glacier Bay. In part two, we see the lengths the rafters will go to avoid being trapped by icebergs.
At the Shawshe Meadows put-in point in the Yukon Territory, the Tachinshini is a modest-sized river, less than 100 yards wide. The jade-green waters descend toward the Alsek River and eventually the Gulf of Alaska, but they give no hint of the radically different river just a few days' float away. As our party of five people in two rafts float downstream, we head deeper into the world's tallest coastal mountains, the St. Elias Range. Where the landscape isn't vegetated, it feels raw and naked. So new, it hasn't found its angle of repose. Boulders and gravel tumble without warning. Raw glacial creeks pour into the tot, invisible boulders clacking downstream in the muddy current. Each creek adds to the river's flow, and the tot keeps growing. 3 days in, it's half a mile wide. You can travel for days at a time here without seeing any signs of human activity, let alone any other people. But we happened to overtake a group of rafters from Idaho. Freelance photographer and avid river rafter Glenn Oakley of Boise says down south, there's nothing like the Alsek in either size or speed.
At one point, we were going 14 miles an hour in a raft. that's fast. That's ripping. And when stuff's coming at you, when you've got to make decisions, especially in a raft, way in advance, because otherwise you're going to end up in a place you may not want to be.
About 80 miles into the trip, we float across the invisible border back into Alaska. The Alsek is now 2 miles wide. It feels more like an ocean than a river. At one point, you can see 24 glaciers in every direction. The mind boggles to comprehend the scale. River runners here call it sensory overload syndrome. On a river this wide and fast, we know we have to pick our route far upstream to get to shore at any particular spot.
On most whitewater trips, you pull over and hike downstream a bit to scout any big rapids. But on the Alsek, you scout for icebergs. We've pulled over near the end of a peninsula that juts out into the entrance to Alsek Lake, which is covered in icebergs, and we're scouting down to see if there's a pass through that won't be choked with icebergs. The narrow passage through the lake is called the Channel of Death, so we're going to check it out to see if it's passable or whether we're going to have a long portage.
Trip organizer Julie Scheuer of Juneau sees an unwelcome, if not unexpected, sight in the lake.
Yeah, all the ice smashed against the knob. It's not just smashed up against it, it's like piled up on it.
Unfortunately, we also get our first glimpse of our potential portage around the lake. Through the binoculars, it appears an apartment building-sized iceberg is blocking our plan B out of here. So we hike to the end of a peninsula for a better vantage. Kevin Hood of Juneau thinks there might be a passage through the icebergs that we can't quite see.
There may still be a way. This is a huge volume of water going, and it's just hard from this slanted perspective.
Yeah. But it's like a maze.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not willing to get stuck in the middle of a bunch of icebergs.
Dissension in the ranks, so we hike to a small hilltop for another perspective. We see that apartment building of ice isn't actually blocking our back channel portage. So instead of pushing our luck with the towers and slabs of ancient ice in the Channel of Death, we decide to take the rafts overland. We get back in the rafts and head to the mostly dry river channel that bypasses the iciest parts of Alsek Lake. We unload the rafts and scour the riverbanks for long, smooth pieces of driftwood. They'll work as primitive rollers to get the heavy rafts across a quarter-mile portage. Now it's time to earn our safety with
one,
some hard labor.
1, 2, 3!
Two hours later, we've got all the gear back in the boats. We row around the corner to the last campsite of our 10-day trip and a well-earned rest. We sit by the fire, look out toward the forked tongue of the Alsek Glacier, listen to icebergs rumble and crack, and savor the adventure stories we'll have to tell later on. On the Alsek River, I'm John Ryan.
The drama of the Iditarod will reach millions of Americans beginning next month when a new reality show on The Last Great Race debuts. Two-time defending Iditarod champion Lance Mackey of Fairbanks is one of seven mushers central to the Discovery Channel program.
How do you survive over 1,100 miles of frozen hell? Run for your life. From the producers of Deadliest Catch.
These are my family members.
They are the two athletes here.
Comes an all-new series.
So stressed out right now, it's killing me.
About the last great race.
Hi, girls. Hi.
And those brave enough.
If I lose my team, I can die.
To take it on.
Discovery Channel producers set up mushers with battery-powered cameras and microphones to capture their experiences while running from Anchorage to Nome during last year's race. The edited footage will air during 6 one-hour-long episodes beginning October 14th. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from John Ryan in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Bonnie Sue Hitchcock in Sitka, and Ed Schoenfeld in Prince Rupert, British Columbia. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Profit is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Wells Fargo, providing personal attention from people who live and work right here in Alaska. Wells Fargo, the next stage.
Grant Station, finding grants for nonprofit organizations, schools, and governmental agencies throughout the U.S. and Canada. Grant Station, fast track to funding. On the web at grantstation.com.
And by the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.